This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. I had the privilege of meeting him last year at a seminar, so it's an honor to be speaking to him again. Corey Richards is one of the world's most recognized adventure and mountaineering photographers and National Geographic Adventure of the Year in 2012. Beyond his extraordinary work in photography, Corey is a survivor of avalanches, PTSD, depression, and many other challenges. In 2011, during his descent of Pakistan's Gusher Broom 2, the world's 13th tallest mountain, he and his two friends were nearly killed by an avalanche. The near-death experience broke him, plunging him to a world of PTSD and alcohol abuse. His adolescent years were also rocky and saw him dropping out of high school, living on the streets, and struggling with drug addiction. What's happened since, we'll find out in just a moment. Good to speak to you again, Corey. To put it mildly, you've been through a lot. We'll start with, when did this sense of adventure plus photography begin?
Well, you know, it's funny. To begin with, my life started sort of as it started as a quote unquote adventurous one. My parents were very, very adamant about getting my brother and I outside. They felt that our upbringing was best balanced by small adventures at first, but certainly experiential learning, and learning that put us more in positions of having to discover and in some ways push our own boundaries. And that was from really as early as I can remember. I started skiing when I was 2 years old. I started climbing when I was 5 years old. And what's interesting is, as I look back and try to sort of unravel how photography came into the mix, what I remember is that visual arts were always a very, very strong part of my young life. And for a long time, I thought I was going to go into illustration. That's what I spent hours doing when I wasn't outside, was just drawing endlessly. And as I grew up, it occurred to me that I actually sort of gravitated towards more instant gratification, and photography was a beautiful expression of sort of the creative process that I found myself most ignited by, and also didn't require as much time as sort of the visual arts that I had initially engaged in. So at about in my late teens, when I started, after this very tumultuous time, having dropped out of high school, which you mentioned, and having sort of bounced around on the streets, as I started gravitating back towards climbing, back towards being outside, I felt as though I needed a vehicle or a tool with which to tell that story. So it was at that time that I really picked up the camera and started trying to document my experience, which was, and my identity, which was rooted around adventure and exploration. So it was really in the late teens that I started to explore this avenue.
Right. I remember hearing you speak, and you have an interesting relationship with your brother.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. And if we want to get into the psychology of it, I'm really happy to do that, because I think it's important to understand the underpinnings of any relationship. If you want to understand dynamics and interpersonal dynamics, I think you have to go pretty far back, and you have to understand yourself, and you have to understand sort of the nature in which your relationship blossomed with whoever it is. And so if I look at it, my best sort of unraveling of this takes it back to before I was even born, and looking at my mother and how she suffered from postpartum depression with my brother. And what that does for an infant in their sort of precognitive years, that 0 to 3 age, is it creates, or it can create, what are called insecure attachments. And those insecure attachments essentially amount to emotional needs, and that emotional feedback loop of an infant and the relationship with their primary caregiver, that feedback loop not being completed, and their emotional needs aren't met. And it's not the fault of the primary caregiver, the mother, because as we all know, postpartum depression is something that happens. That's a normal part of life. And navigating that, I think, is as troubling and confusing for the mother, certainly, as for the child later on. So it's not an issue of blame. What that did was created a sense within my brother whereby he needed to find means through which he could get his emotional needs met. And one of the best ways that he found was when I came along, you know, 2 years later, he found that, you know, poking the baby brother or pushing over the crib or creating some sort of conflict between himself and me actually got him the emotional attention that he needed. Now, bear in mind, this isn't positive emotional attention. It's just attention. So he's short-circuiting that emotional need or that he's getting those emotional needs met. And what that does with me is it creates what's called an inescapable stress and something I can't get away from. And that sort of plants these seeds of trauma from a very, very early age. So essentially what happened is that that behavior of lashing out towards me to get his emotional needs met, which again, I don't blame him for that. That's a coping mechanism that he's devised rather brilliantly and subconsciously in those early years. That never got corrected. And so as we moved into our teens and our adolescence, what can be sort of regular brotherly conflict became amplified, and it grew into genuine physical and emotional abuse that was very violent at times. And that was just our dynamic. And that set us off in a relationship that still to this day we are unraveling and figuring out together. But it's, you know, 40 years later, it's a process.
Right. Now, that near-death experience in Pakistan finally broke you. Like, what was going through your mind to sink into PTSD and alcohol abuse at that time?
Well, so what's really interesting is, and I love that you asked the question about my brother, it's because of the relationship with my brother and the violence that we experienced together, and more beyond the violence, it was the rage. All of that has an effect on a developing brain. And what it does is it creates what are sort of generally referred to as little traumas. Some of them can be bigger. But as the brain develops, if you're experiencing that kind of duress, those inescapable stresses, and you're experiencing violence and rage and emotional abuse, and again, I'm not blaming him, this is just what happened, all it takes then is one more dramatic or traumatic event to tip a person into a post-traumatic stress disorder sort of scenario. So imagine the brain as sort of this fertile field that's been planted with all these seeds of trauma, and then all it needs is a powerful rainstorm, and then boom, your brain is off and running, and everything that has been sort of fostered to that point comes to fruition. And any sort of pathological behavior, anything that can help you navigate that extreme stress that you are now under gets amplified. And so that's why you see people diving into, addictive behaviors and addictive patterns. And what those are, again, they're coping mechanisms to calm that internal spinning, that trapped experience that has become lodged in your brain until there's a resolution. So it's really interesting to observe the behavior of people who have experienced trauma. They'll often try to recreate that same situation in order to find resolution, because ultimately what the trauma does is it leaves you without resolution, especially when it's a near-death experience. And of course, in my case, that sort of snowballed into alcohol abuse and just sort of a mess in my life.
It was the straw that broke the camel's back, I guess. And more importantly, how did you get out of it?
Coming out of depression or anxiety and depression that's linked to post-traumatic stress disorder, coming out of addictive behaviors is a process. It is not something that happens overnight. It's not a decision that you make. It doesn't work quite like that. What it requires and what it required from me was exhaustive, introspection and therapy, a huge exploration into understanding what trauma is, how the body stores trauma, why I was experiencing PTSD, that it wasn't strictly about an avalanche. It wasn't about climbing, that it was about something much, much deeper. And then being willing to have an honest dialogue within myself, but also outwardly with a therapist and doctors, and describing the experience in order to A, identify what was actually happening, and B, start to resolve the trauma that is lodged. And once you start to resolve that trauma, then you can start to address behaviors, right? And so, you know, there were years where I mean, this process really is ongoing. It took me, I would say, from the time of the avalanche until I was back in a healthy state was, gosh, almost 7 years or 6 years. And that was when I finally made the decision to, you know, I needed to quit drinking, but it took a lot of recognition of behavior and patterns before I could even identify that the alcohol and the behaviors around alcohol were part of this cycle that I was in. You know, it took a lot of, again, deep honesty and willingness to say, well, okay, what am I doing to cope with this? And what does that look like? So, you know, it was 2016 before I actually quit drinking, which was 6 years after the avalanche.
Wow. Yeah. So, and that's the thing, right? It doesn't happen overnight, but the decision would have started ages ago. You know, so anyway, we'll talk a little bit more about your adventures and upcoming adventures in just a moment. I'm Frida Liu. You're listening to Race Again, BFM 89.9.
Behind Famous Men, BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
This is Race Again. Good morning. I'm Frida Liu. I'm speaking to Corey Richards, one of the world's most recognized adventure and mountaineering photographers and National Geographic Adventurer of the Year in 2012. In 2018, you took part in the final challenge, documenting your journey in a camouflage Rolls-Royce Cullinan, an undertaking to test the world's pinnacle SUV to destruction. Tell me about that adventure.
I love how life unravels. I love how life unfolds. I love how these things that happen in life that can be terrible at the time end up leading you into some of the most beautiful relationships and experiences you have. And my relationship with Rolls-Royce and the opportunity to be part of the Cullinan testing phase where we were taking the final vehicle all over the world and literally trying to break it. You know, none of that would have happened had my life not unfolded exactly as it had to that point. And so there's a lot of recognition that I have to thank Rolls-Royce for the opportunity for allowing so much of my past to inform the person that they actually ended up partnering with. And we, you know, this experience was wildly in left field for me because my life has been about radical discomfort, right? And this was all about actually using something that was designed to be sort of the pinnacle of luxury to actually access places that I would normally go in an uncomfortable way. And, you know, rather than sleeping on rocks, I'm sort of flying private as an allegory or like as a metaphor. It was, again, a crazy departure. And what was so cool about it was it reframed or it allowed me some insight into my own artistic and my own athletic endeavors in that it doesn't have to be uncomfortable all the time. In fact, if you put more energy into process, engineering, design, reduction, you can come up with something, be it a product or an adventure, that can be more streamlined and actually work better. It can be, you know, it can function at the highest capacity if you actually just put more attention to detail. And so, you know, driving the car all over the Scottish Highlands, driving it through the empty quarter, I mean, driving it all over the American West in these places that I normally would identify as being sort of rugged and uncomfortable in the lap of luxury was a crazy new experience for me.
Right. And it's not to quote Steve Jobs, right? We only can connect the dots looking back, right?
Right.
You know, so I just want to find out with the lockdown, what have you been up to? You know, how has this whole experience, I don't know, has it changed your thinking on things?
Well, it's interesting. I can relate this to the experience with Rolls-Royce in that there you can reframe how you look at things, right? And the lockdown and quarantine has absolutely helped me reframe how I view and perceive my job, my place in the world, and my future. And I think there's still questioning around my future. I want to dive deeper into those questions. I think my experience in adventure and exploration and the willingness to be uncomfortable has allowed me a certain ability that I'm very grateful for to simply relax into what's happening. It is uncomfortable. And anytime we're faced with big questions and uncertainty, it's deeply uncomfortable. And my experience to this point has allowed me to sort of say, okay, this is a familiar feeling. I don't necessarily like it, but if I can be okay with it, there's a lot of information that I can pull from this. For example, why is it uncomfortable? Why is uncertainty uncomfortable? What am I scared of? Am I scared of not having the same sort of trajectory and pathway forward? What does that look like if I don't have it? What else could I do? And allowing my brain to actually ask those questions. And again, I know that, I have to speak very clearly about this because it's the time to speak about it. And it always has been, the ability for me to ask those big questions comes from a place of privilege. And it's important that I actually look at that as well right now and say, God, I'm very grateful to be able to ask these questions, and B, I need to look at why I'm able to ask these questions. Because to be fair, somebody who's followed my trajectory in life, especially early on, somebody who has dropped out of high school, that takes a huge amount of arrogance, who has continually made mistakes in life, a person, especially in America, potentially of a different race or a different gender, might not have had the same second, third, fourth, fifth chances that I had. And so unraveling that is really important right now too. And that's uncomfortable.
Right. You know, one of the things you talked about was thinking big and extending our boundaries, right? Why do you think that's so important?
I love the idea that if we aim, it's, and I'm slaughtering the quote, but if you aim for the stars, you're still going to hit the moon, right? I am a strong believer that when we think big, we provide a pathway forward towards accomplishment that we might otherwise deem impossible. So I love the quote. It's a Jay-Z quote that says, difficult takes a day, impossible takes a week. I believe that thinking big, that the pursuit of greatness and having, wildly unrealistic dreams at times can be helpful to us because it gives us a roadmap forward. Now, if we don't accomplish maybe that far off dream, even if we follow the roadmap towards it, we're going to accomplish more than we ever imagined possible. And I think this moment right now that we're in, where we have these deep-seated discomforts, where we have this fear, that can be a great catalyst towards maybe a different calling in our lives, or the same calling, but a more fuller expression of whatever it is. I just believe that we have to believe in ourselves, and we have to believe that we can accomplish big, great things. If we don't believe that, then how can we ever do it?
Hmm. Are there some principles you live by that's non-negotiable?
I mean, yes and no, but they're very simple. And I think that people always want a deeper wisdom. But the principles that I try to live by genuinely every day are A, live honestly to the best of your ability. And that can be very, very hard. And sometimes we fail. And B, treat other people with genuine respect and kindness, even with, and especially when you disagree with them. And I try to surround myself with people that might have differing opinions. Of course, we fall into the trap of surrounding ourselves with people that agree, but I want to keep my mind sort of injected with conflicting ideas so that I stay fresh. I can actually try and be nimble with how I view the world. And I want to be able to adapt my thinking and learn and grow. I don't want to be stuck in a certain way or sort of a certain pathology that keeps me from evolving. So A, I try to be honest with myself so I can see where I might fall short, where I might fail. And B, I want to be kind and generous and genuinely engaged with people around me. I think it's so like living by the golden rule, treat other people as you would want to be treated. And it's so weird that we have to repeat that and say that. But imagine a world if we all lived by that simple virtue. Imagine how that would feel and imagine what the world would look like.
Right. What are you up to next?
Right now, it's all up in the air and I'm kind of loving it. I've been doing a little bit more work around home. Some of my ad work and advertising photography work has come back. Some of my editorial work is starting to uptick again. I'm working on some television shows where I'm more in a hosting position, so on camera. And I also am training, and this is sort of what's eating up most of my time right now. I'm amidst a training process and cycle for my second attempt on a new unclimbed route on the northeast face of Everest next spring. So my partner and I are just in that training cycle, trying to be the best we can possibly be when it comes time to leave next April.
Right. Okay. So you've got a little less than a year. And a final question, what's Corey Rich's vision in the grand scheme of things?
My vision for what?
List them in life.
Well, first and foremost, I mean, I think that goes back to sort of, it plays into what we were talking about around virtues and ideologies that I try to live by. My vision for my life is to never stop evolving. I want to continually evolve. I want to be a lifelong learner. I want to foster, celebrate curiosity and try to amplify that and express that. Through art, I feel as though it is my responsibility to try to bring to light issues that are either overlooked or under-celebrated, and I can do better at that. I feel like that is sort of one of the acts in my life, and I'm looking forward to the second and third act. Ultimately, I'd like to pursue policy. And I don't know when that starts to happen, but it's something that I'm very interested in. And I don't know what my role in that necessarily is yet, but I am excited to pursue it. But I think that's a little further down the road. And again, I want to evolve so that whatever impact I'm having genuinely leaves the world a better, more inclusive and healthier place than when I came into it. And we're in a moment right now where we need so much more of that. So, however I can play my role, and of course I will make mistakes in that role. I will fall and I will fail, and hopefully I can take the feedback to learn and continue to evolve. But I genuinely just want to leave this place better than when I came into it. And I want to do that through art, exploration, policy, and above all else, kindness and love. And I know that sounds a little woo-woo, but that's my life. That's what I believe in.
Right. Such a pleasure to be speaking to you. I was speaking to Corey Richards, and you've been listening to Raise Your Game, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.